welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFURL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and for those of you who may have just joined us now, my guest is Kadri Leek, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome, Kadri.
Hello, my pleasure.
All right, great to have you on the podcast again. Thanks for joining us. Now, the first question I'd like to ask, I'm going to give this quite a bit of a long introduction, so please bear with me, but is about the state of Russia's war against Ukraine as it stands now, as winter approaches, and what the role of the West is, or perhaps kind of should be at this juncture. Since Russia's large-scale invasion of Ukraine in February, there have been several phases in the war, at least I see it that way. Some of the phases certainly overlapping, and all of them marked by heavy bombardments that have very often caused civilian casualties, by evidence of atrocities by Russian soldiers on the ground, and by major setbacks for the Russian military and for President Vladimir Putin's goal of subjugating Ukraine. There was Russia's initial push toward Kyiv in the first weeks after the invasion, and then its retreat from that area from the north of Ukraine. There was the siege and destruction of Mariupol, the large Azov Sea port city that Russian and separatist forces had been unable to seize over the 8 years of war in the Donbass since 2014, but did seize and pretty much razed to the ground this spring. And there were the Ukrainian counteroffensives, mainly in the Kharkiv and Kherson regions in the east and south, in recent months, including the Russian retreat and Ukrainian recapture of the city of Kherson, the only regional capital that Russian forces had seized since the invasion on February 24th. And the current phase, there's fighting going on certainly in the east and south, as there has been throughout. But I'd say that for the outside world, at least, the current phase is marked primarily maybe by the repeated Russian attacks on infrastructure, particularly energy and power infrastructure that are serving civilians. And these attacks have plunged cities into darkness and cold and sent Ukraine scrambling to restore power repeatedly. In recent weeks. Now, the attacks seem aimed to break the will of Ukraine and Ukrainians, and some Russian officials have essentially said this. But so far, they appear to be having the opposite effect, once again sharpening Ukraine's resolve. At the same time, after the successful Ukrainian counteroffensives, there are a few signs, I would say, that either side is likely to take large amounts of territory in the very near future. And as winter approaches, and it is very close, by the calendar it starts in about 3 weeks, but by tradition it starts in 3 days, the war seems likely to continue well into next year. At least that's how I see it. So this leaves me wondering about the West's role, the role of the United States and the European Union, NATO countries. They've been imposing sanctions and providing weapons to Ukraine. And so far, I think there are a few major signs, at least, that this support is about to flag. But let me ask you, Kadri, do you see a big danger of that this winter, of Western support for Ukraine decreasing? And is there something the West could perhaps do or should start doing differently at this point to try to bring the end of the war closer and I guess, victory for Ukraine closer?
Thanks, Steve. Thank you for inviting me. And it's good you are asking about Western resolve. I'm just finishing a study about European opinions about the war, Russia, and where it all is going. And to be honest, I don't see weakening of resolve at all. I mean, times are hard for Europeans as well as Ukraine. Countries are doing whatever they can to make themselves resilient because, I mean, Putin is targeting Europe as well as Ukraine. Energy shortages over coming winter are meant to make Europe rethink its help to Ukraine. But I do not think that is happening. Europe has been remarkably effective trying to shore up gas supplies for the coming winter. And I think now one almost dares to say that Europe will be fine this winter. Energy might be more expensive, but it will be there. And I would even dare to say that next year's supplies will be harder because gas storages cannot be filled with gas from Russia anymore, probably. But even so, I somehow assume that Europe will find a way to come to terms with it. There is quite a lot of nervous but creative energy in the EU these days, lots of problem solving. And I think Europe is also expanding its aid to Ukraine. And sort of sending what is needed. I mean, we could see how many countries sent air defense systems when Russia ramped up its air campaign against civilian infrastructure. Right now, as far as I know, many countries are trying to help Ukraine fix the infrastructure, power stations, etc., or create connections that would allow Ukraine to get electricity from Europe. All these things are being worked on. So, frankly, I don't think that resolve will get weaker. It could be that not enough will be available in terms of military hardware because production systems take a short while to get going. That's not something you can do overnight. So obstacles like these might be there. But in terms of willpower, no, I don't think so.
Okay, thanks. That's very helpful. And I guess I would ask sort of a follow-up question. It does seem like the Russian strategies for diminishing, for undermining both Ukrainian resolve and resolve in the West to help Ukraine seem to backfire all the time, and, you know, like other like some of their strategies, I guess, on the battlefield. But, I mean, I wonder if the this effort, apparently effort by Russia to break Ukrainians' resolve by hitting at their infrastructure, you know, literally making them cold in winter and bringing darkness. It seems like, you know, in terms of the Western response, it's hard to look at that and think, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't help as much. On the contrary, I would think that many people in the West would respond by saying, well, you know, we may have it bad or worse than we have in past winters, but, you know, look at Ukraine, you know, they're really bearing the brunt of this, so we can help. I mean, do you think that's sort of a factor in the, you know, what you say is apparent continuation or non-decrease of Western help or desire to aid Ukraine?
Well, I think desire to aid is first and foremost motivated by the nature of that war. I mean, massive and completely unprovoked war. That is just a glaring injustice, and that calls for help. And of course, Russia has mismanaged the leverage it could have had. Like with energy supplies, I mean, to use energy as a weapon, that already means that you make your customers wary and cautious, and they will start looking for alternative ways. So the whole idea of trying to imply to, say, Germany that, okay, if you change your behavior, you can get our gas again. I mean, the thing it's doing in Berlin is making clear to people that this is not a reliable supplier. They use gas to manipulate our policymaking and sort of self-evident outcome here is that Germany will rethink its energy policy, as it is doing. And I think that would be the case even if the two Nord Stream pipelines had not been blown up, because the psychological effect told Germany everything they needed to know. And of course, it backfires also, I mean, not just in terms of West picking sides and trying to help Ukraine, but I think it's backfiring also financially. I mean, Russia had still decent energy revenues, also from gas, because even if it lost some of its export routes and customers, price of gas was so high that that actually compensated for quite a lot was for what was lost in terms of customers. Now, next year might not be the same anymore. And if gas prices are lower and Russia's customer base will have shrunk, as it will, then it could actually result in financial blow as well. And of course, none of this comes easy to the West either. I mean, these days you are seeing the discussions about price cap, subsidies, inflation. It is a mess, looked at the Western side as well. But I think it would be wrong to interpret the fact that it's a mess as a sign that the West will give up and Russia can have its way. I don't think that'll happen.
Yeah, thanks very much for that. It does seem kind of like going back to any not even business as usual, but sort of the situation as it was before seems kind of impossible at this point. And thanks for pointing out that, you know, beyond the use of energy as a weapon, you know, there's just the kind of basic injustice of the unprovoked invasion. So there's that as well, and the way Russian forces have conducted themselves as factors in the Western response. All right, well, thanks very much. The second question I'd like to ask goes back to the incident on November 15th, in which a missile, at first it was said to be two missiles, I'm not sure, but a missile hit inside Poland, close to the Ukrainian border, killing two people. There was a lot of concern that this could lead to a very serious escalation, as Poland is a NATO member, of course, particularly when reports said that it was a Russian missile. Now, the main one of those reports turned out to be kind of based on a source and presumably inaccurate. It was badly sourced. But in any case, those fears certainly were raised. Now, Poland and the head of NATO later said it appears to have been a Ukrainian air defense missile that fell in Poland. The United States said it saw no evidence to contradict that. And I should mention that Western officials are stressing that the blame lies with Russia, in any case, because nothing of the kind would have happened if Russia had not attacked Ukraine. In fact, this incident occurred on the day of a massive Russian bombardment, one of the biggest kind of across the country since the invasion. But my question is whether kind of going forward, whether this incident is likely to have any substantial effect on the war and or on attitudes in Europe toward the war. I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, Kadri.
Thanks. I don't think, frankly, that this incident will have a major effect on anything, because it was obvious that it was an accident. Had it been a Russian missile, it would also have been an accident. And these things happen. If there is a war, then some missiles will go astray. That's not even the first one. Moldova was hit a couple of weeks, or is it a couple of months now ago, as well. And, you know, this is not to dismiss it, because in Poland, two people died. That's already very bad. But, you know, this doesn't make it a Russian-NATO war and should not make it. So I think this is not something, I mean, this will not be the major episode we will be remembering about that war when one day it is over. We will quite likely forget it. I wonder even why Ukrainians were so adamant that it wasn't a Ukrainian missile. Maybe it was really their take, then I understand. But if they thought that admitting that it was Ukrainian missile will somehow make European support to Ukraine any weaker, I don't think that's not the case at all. I think there is sufficient understanding of whose fault these things are. But
right,
go ahead, ask.
Yeah, no, there was certainly no kind of indication from the start, I think, that anyone was really blaming Ukraine, maybe on some levels, but yeah, I see what you're saying. And I'm wondering whether this incident might help NATO kind of be prepared for things like this in the future and kind of have a good kind of base of experience to react to things that happen and that may or may not pose like a serious security challenge.
I don't know if you can be prepared for such things. You can defend places that you think might be targeted, and I think, for instance, airfields in Poland are pretty solidly defended now by NATO air defense, because one cannot exclude that Russia at one day might decide that it needs to attack supply routes to Ukraine. But just a random countryside point hit by accidental air defense missile, I'm not sure how much one can do about it. So I'm afraid that is the collateral damage you cannot really, really prevent.
Yeah, absolutely. And I interrupted you. I think you were going to say something else.
Yeah, no, just your wider question about what do Europeans think where this war is going. In my recent research into European thinking, we have asked about that. And people seem to think that it'll take a long time. It's a long war for Europe. And they're not sure about the outcome. So it's not like Ukraine will win and they will support it until it happens. Support is there, but outcome for Europeans is still very much on uncertain. And you can see on the battlefield as well that, you know, Ukraine makes some advances, some amazing victories, like Kharkiv, like Kherson, but these come at a price, and they are not so easy to repeat. So the outcome, I think, remains unknown for the time being. And that makes it, I think, in my view, even more admirable that Europeans seem to be gearing up psychologically to accept come what may.
That's a very interesting point. I mean, I've found that for myself, you know, my kind of hopes or expectations of an outcome, I would say, differ from, you know, some people who are seem very sure of what the outcome will be. not necessarily when it might come, but what it will be. So I think that's a great point about the idea that while Europeans in many cases don't know what the outcome will be, at least for now, and for the foreseeable future, they are, the support, as you say, the support is there. Okay, I'd like to take a few questions, if there are any questions from listeners. Give it a few moments.
Hi, yeah, I had a question about, I guess, Ukraine, its relationship with NATO, and how, assuming Ukraine is able to liberate most or all of its territory, how will it guarantee its security in between that stage and a potentially a NATO accession?
That's a good question to which I don't have an answer. I mean, future security arrangements for Ukraine is something that everyone knows needs to be discussed at one point. But it will also be so dependent in some ways on the outcome of the war that it's hard to discuss these matters while the war is still going on. And frankly, maybe that should not even be the priority right now. I mean, the discussions we had in the early days of the war about certain countries giving security guarantees to Ukraine, and there has been some work done about it. A paper was prepared over the summer. But to be honest, I don't think that is realistic at all. I mean, that would basically mean, at least the way it was talked early on, it would have been a few countries, X number of countries, obliging to guarantee Ukraine's security. That would mean they would be ready to go to war against Russia to defend Ukraine. I don't think that is realistic, and frankly, I was surprised to see that some fairly serious countries volunteered for the role, like Germany. I'm not sure what Chancellor Scholz was thinking. Maybe he was hoping that such a gesture would hope to allow to stop the war, and then we will see what can be done. I don't know, but I think long term that is in any case unrealistic. So what the exact arrangements for Ukraine will be, I don't know, and where even it will be discussed. I think NATO membership will certainly be discussed with a renewed force, and Ukraine has a lot stronger case now than it had earlier, but it is surely not a done deal either, very, very far from that. So I think we can discuss it when we get there, and it is still some way off.
All right, thanks very much, Kadri. Any more questions? We can take one more, at least. Okay, if not, last chance, but if no more questions, we can start to wrap it up. So, Kadri, once again, very great insights, and thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you.
All right, once again, I've been speaking to Kadri Leek, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. My name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. As I mentioned, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'll be back next Monday for another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia, and please keep an eye out for my newsletter, The Week in Russia, this Friday. Thanks for listening.